Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now, I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I'm married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell, so you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
And welcome to the Carol the Coach Show. Hey, this is Sex Help with Carol the Coach, and this is, to my knowledge, the only sexual addiction show that there is on the internet. So I welcome you to the show. I know that if you're listening, well, you more than likely have felt like you might have a problem, or somebody you love may have a problem. And so you are doing your best to find out what you can do about this situation anonymously. And I say anonymously because if you have been exploring sex and you feel that it's addictive, your whole MO is about anonymous. You know, we say it here that sexual addiction is so prevalent because it is affordable. You can get on the internet and peruse anything you want to see. It is anonymous. You do it and nobody necessarily knows what you're doing, and it's accessible. All you have to have is a smartphone, a phone that has a data plan. We call it porn in the pocket. Or, of course, all you have to have is internet connection. And that gets you going. You know, that may not be your sexual addiction of choice, but that clearly revs up the brain. And it, you know, for some people, I got to tell you, they can look at some porn and it's not a big deal. They don't get an addiction. They are able to control it, and it doesn't interfere with their life. However, if you're one of the tens of thousands of people that are listening to the show, then you probably know that it's out of control. It is something you have tried to stop over and over and over again. You had good intentions. You told yourself, that's it, I'm going to stop on Monday, I'm going to stop after Father's Day, I'm going to stop now that my wife has caught me. And then, whether it be a minute, an hour, a day, a week, a month, maybe even a year, later you started the behavior. And let's face it, when you can't control something and it is unmanageable, and it is interfering with how you feel about yourself as well as how you're interacting with your partner, your family, then you know you've got a problem. And this show is really kind of unique in that I talk a lot about what sexual addiction is, and I've made it my mission to help you out because I know it's a deep, dark secret, and that's why I want to be available to you. At the same time, I interview the experts, people all over the world that have written books, that have started treatment centers, that work in treatment centers, that work in private practice, you name it, I interview them because they always have some information to share. Now, I was recently talking to a man who is an airline pilot, and you know, he says, boy, I can't seem to get to any meetings. And I said, you know, it may be more difficult for you than the average person, but I got to tell you that between meetings all over the world and telephone meetings, you have no excuse not to be part of a 12-step program for sexual addiction. And so if you're listening for the first time, you may not have even known that there are 12-step programs available. So get on the internet if you still have that capability and go to sexaddictsanonymous.com or sexanonymous.com and find out where the meetings are or how you can participate in phone meetings if you don't have one available to your, you know, in your area. There are plenty of areas that don't have these meetings yet, but I guarantee you, give it about 10 years, and they'll be prevalent all over. So just hang in there. Use the resources you've got. And for some of you, that means telemeetings and the show and bibliotherapy. You know, go to www.sexhelp.com. Go to General Path Publishers. They provide exclusively sexual addictions materials. And if this is your first time for listening, then you know you may not know that I've been trained by Patrick Carnes, who has written more books than anybody else on the field of sexual addiction. Now, tonight, I've got to tell you, I am very excited to be talking with a woman, Jan Beauregard, and she is going to be talking about her sexual addiction practice, the clients she sees, the brain disease she believes that sexual addiction is, the trauma she finds to be prevalent in sexual addiction. And, you know, she is very excited to be able to disseminate information to you. So I highly recommend, she's very personable. I highly recommend that you stay tuned to the show. She's going to be on at about 9:15. And literally, she is part of Integrative Psychotherapy Institute, IPI, and it's out of Fairfax, Virginia. And she's been working with these folks for a long time, and she's found some alternative forms of treatment that she believes is very helpful to sexual addiction. Believe it or not, you know, having a good certified sexual addictions therapist is imperative in treatment, as well as finding different forms of mindfulness that help you center on what you need in your life to clear away some of the blame, the shame, the guilt, and help you focus on accessing your higher power as well as your inner self. So she is amazing, and I can't wait to interview her. She's going to be talking about integrated sensory-motor psychotherapy, the ego state, internal family systems therapy, and trauma-sensitive yoga techniques as she works with sexual addiction. And she's found this to be incredibly helpful in recovery. Now, if you have ever been in a treatment center, then you know there are many, many modes of treatment that can be helpful. And anybody who's been in a treatment center has learned yoga and mindfulness and meditation. They've practiced art therapy, journaling, narrative therapy, They've done timelines. They've been able to access what were some of their traumas. And for some of you that may not feel you have traumas, and you might not, they were able to access the first time they ever witnessed any form of any kind of sexual addiction, whether it had been pornography or magazines. And for whatever reason, the brain locked onto those things and made a rut, actually, in the neurocircuitry of the brain. And so we're really learning that sexual addiction is a result of neurochemistry that's occurred in the brain. It's not just your willpower here that we're talking about. It's what's fired up the brain to light up, and just like cocaine, just like meth, just like alcoholism, it is a drug that numbs the feelings, numbs the experiences, and, you know, anything that numbs you, that takes away from the feeling, may have initially been helpful, but now we see it as definitely a problem in terms of how to get healthy. So, I got to tell you, sorry about that, I just had a big gulp of coffee. I'm going to be excited to talk about different avenues and methods that you can utilize to get healthy. Now, I've got a website, and that website is www.sexhelpwithcarolthecoach.com. And I have an email. If you're a little nervous about calling in to the show, which is 646-595-3284, you can always email me. Email me your issues, your concerns. You know, last week we talked with somebody who was seeing a certified sexual addictions therapist. They were in a therapy group. They were doing everything that they thought was physically possible, but they were still struggling with love addiction and sex addiction. Now, I say, and this is my belief, that in 99 out of 100 cases, if you're working an active recovery program, if you are going to many 12-step meetings in a week, perhaps it's 90 meetings in 90 days, perhaps it's 5 out of 7 days, at best at least 3 out of 7 days, and you've got a sponsor, and you're doing your bibliotherapy, you are reading SAA or SA, you are reading perhaps Out of the Shadows, Facing the Shadows, Mending the Shattered Heart. Maybe you're reading The Storm of Sex Addiction by Connie Lofgren, which is an excellent book. If you're doing that reading, you're going to 12-step meetings frequently, you've got yourself a sponsor, you're making at least 2 to 3 calls to the community at large, and you're involved in therapy, whether that be group, individual, marital, or family, you're working a strong program, and it will absolutely affect your recovery in a positive way. I've worked with many people who've been into treatment, and they thought, oh my gosh, you know, I was in treatment for a month, 6 weeks, 2 months, 3 months. Why aren't I better? Well, unfortunately, what we know is you can stay better in a treatment center, but if you don't apply that recovery plan to the outside, if you don't work it as strong outside when you're back at home as when you were in treatment, maybe at the Meadows, maybe at the Ranch, maybe at Keystone, maybe at Capstone, if you're not doing all that work diligently, you're going to likely slip into old patterns. That's how strong the addiction is. And so I have two things to say. I say get with your program and work it hard or go back to treatment. Because what we know is that a treatment for addiction may take 1, 2, or 3 tries. And especially if you're not working a program. Because if you're not working a program that's strong, the addiction will be stronger than you are. That's not just you, that's anybody. So think about what you may be doing for your addiction. You know, have you just begun to start reading? And that's how you got on iTunes and you searched sexual addiction and you found my show? Well, that's a good start, but that's not going to be enough to curb this addiction. You have to work it from every single aspect. And I know that you can. You know, so many people go, I don't want to work that hard, Carol. I'm sick of working that hard. You know, I don't want my whole life to be defined by my sexual addiction. Well, I guarantee you it won't be. But for the first 2, 3, 4, or even 5 years, you got to work it like it's your life. If it's life or death for you. And, you know, if you're somebody, you can go to 3 meetings and make 2 phone calls. You got a sponsor. You're doing a little bit of reading. You're in with a certified sexual addictions therapist, and that's good enough. Well, then good for you. But most people that are plagued with this illness require that they utilize all of the factors, all of the tools, all the recovery tools to make it better. And that's why we have this show. We definitely want for you to get healthier, and we want you to have the education possible to make that happen. And that's why we have Jan Beauregard on the line, who is an amazing therapist and has made it her mission to work with sexual addiction. So, hey, Jan, welcome to the Sex Help with Carol the Coach show. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit about what most influenced and changed your work with sex addiction clients over the past few years.
Well, I have been a lifelong learner, and I began my education in substance abuse and later expanded to the sexual addiction field because I found it so much overlapped with addiction to substances. And through that last part of my education, I realized how much trauma and having a trauma-informed approach to working with addiction really contributed to my success with this population. So what I, in the last couple years, I've really tried to get a lot of education about the brain and brain science, and I'm convinced now that addiction really is a brain disease.
Mm-hmm. So what made you convinced? What do you know about sexual addiction and the brain disease?
Well, I think one of the doctors that was most influential is Dr. Hilton, who wrote a book called He Restoreth My Soul, and he's from the University of Texas in San Antonio, and he was one of the presenters at the most recent ITAP conference in Scottsdale last year. And basically, through brain scan research and his work as a neurosurgeon, he really has been looking at the brain and the differences in the dopamine system and how pleasure and the use of addictive either drugs or a process addiction like food or sex really changes the brain, in particular the dopamine system.
So when you say it changes the dopamine system, it produces it or it depletes it?
Well, you know, when you do anything that's pleasurable, it produces dopamine. And with an addict, oftentimes, especially if they have a co-occurring disorder like anxiety or depression or a trauma-related disorder, they already have a brain that's somewhat compromised. We know that they have a smaller hippocampus. We know that they have a smaller corpus callosum, which connects the left and right brain together. And we know that if you continue to subject the brain to dopamine, it kind of prompts the craving cycle. And as a result, the frontal lobe can shrink more, and it becomes the damage creates a lot more impulsivity around decision-making, a lot of compulsivity and impaired judgment. So it's all linked into this, you know, this pleasure system. And we know that, you know, the body and the brain are always going to go towards pleasure rather than discipline. We have to be taught, I think, to discipline ourselves, and we're going to value pleasure more. which makes it difficult for the recovery journey.
So in some ways what you're saying is that when somebody engages in sexual addiction over and over and over again, they obviously have triggered that pleasure system.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the addiction is not to the sex per se, but to the dopamine release.
It's to the dopamine and the adrenaline. So in a way, some of these natural substances that, you know, by our right, they're supposed to make us want to eat or want to have sex in order to reproduce, we get addicted to our own chemicals. And it's not very different from someone that might have an addiction to cutting behavior that gets addicted to the opiates that their body produces when they have the cut and the body tries to send chemicals, you know, to soothe and calm, much like they would do in a traumatic accident, you know, a car accident, in order to, you know, to survive the trauma of the accident. The body floods itself with, you know, some of these neurotransmitters, and it's similar in addiction that, you know, adrenaline and dopamine get produced, and then the brain really, you know, wants more of that and starts the addictive process.
Well, that makes sense. And then, again, the book that you recommended is He Restoreth My Soul. Now, that
yes.
sounds somewhat Christian or biblical. Is there any religious affiliation?
Well, this particular doctor stresses in the book that his writing is really science-based, but he doesn't deny the fact that he has a religious affiliation.
Mm-hmm.
So it can't, you know, it's hard to separate probably the spirituality from the man, but he's not writing, you know, in a particular denomination. I guess that would be the best way to frame it.
Okay, give us the name of this doctor again, because that's a new book that I have not ever read.
Yes, his name is Donald Hilton, H-I-L-T-O-N. He's an M.D., and he's a neurological surgeon from the University of Texas in San Antonio. And I'm really pretty convinced that his research, along with some of the other prominent neurosurgeons and people that are really following the biology, are going to be able to get most of these process addictions in our next DSM. It was really a close call. I think, you know, most of us realize that Patrick Carnes and Stephanie Carnes and many others really tried to put together, you know, the research studies to put sex addiction on the map as, you know, really a disorder, a brain disorder, but it didn't quite get approved. And I think the next time around it's going to be really hard to deny the evidence. And they're starting to publish articles now in, you know, the Journal of Science and some of the other more, you know, peer-reviewed journals on this whole, you know, brain, dopamine, adrenaline system, and, you know, the changes in the brain over time.
Well, that makes total sense. And for anybody who's listening that's a clinician, you will know that the DSM is a diagnostic statistical manual for all therapists, psychologists, and doctors. However, for lay people, it is really our Bible that helps us to determine what issues, what disorders you might suffer from. And so this time around, it just got published again, we really tried to get sexual addiction or hypersexuality or obsessive compulsive sexuality into that manual. But just like alcoholism in the 30s, it just has not been recognized to the fullest. And I am so glad that they're really going to be working hard at convincing our psychiatric community that it's not just an issue of addiction, but it's also a brain disorder. Because
well, I think it's so important that it gets in the manual, because until it's legitimized, the funding mm-hmm. and the research, you know, to really do good treatment, it just won't get the funding until it's in that manual, which, like you say, is almost like the Bible for mental health. So, and it's also a stigma to the people that have the addiction for it not to be, you know, considered a real clinical disorder that warrants treatment. And now, you know, unfortunately, there's still, you know, people, even in our own field, that deny the existence of addiction, you know, related to sexual compulsivity. And that's sad for all of our clients that are really struggling.
Oh, and I absolutely agree, although clearly I am seeing more and more and more clinicians who are referencing certified sexual addictions therapists and saying, I don't know what to do with these folks because they're not getting better and what I'm doing isn't working. Is there a model? And certainly
yeah.
you and I both have used Patrick Carn's recovery task model as a recovery formula or program with clients. Now, you actually have got some newer kind of bottom-up approaches used in trauma resolution work that I want to talk about tonight.
Okay.
Because my listeners are both clinicians and lay people who either have the illness and are worried about it but have not necessarily sought help, or their partners, people that they're very, very concerned about. So can you talk a little bit about some of the alternative techniques that you're finding to be so helpful in recovery?
Okay, well, back in 2005, when I attended a major trauma conference in Boston, I had the experience of attending a seminar that was done by Pat Ogden, and I consider Pat Ogden one of the somatic or body work pioneers in the country. And she developed a model called sensory motor psychotherapy, which is really a body-based talk therapy. And what it does for so many of our clients that have co-occurring disorders like PTSD, some trauma-related disorder, or even co-occurring anxiety and depression, many times a lot of that residual dysregulation or the, you know, moods or emotions that they have so much trouble managing that might lead to a craving or a trigger need to be worked on from the bottom up. And by the bottom up, what I really mean is addressing some of the symptoms that are body-based. So with a client, rather than starting out cognitive behaviorally talking about, you know, what are your thoughts about this, what you would learn to do as a therapist is really do reading on nonverbal behavior that a client might be exhibiting. For example, if a client's talking to you and they're you know, their leg is shaking, or if the client is speaking to you and you see trembling or them biting their lip or some other nonverbal sign, you would be curious about that and try to work with that symptom in a way that might help release that symptom and that body movement. So many of our clients are stuck in these repetitive patterns or cycles because they haven't done trauma work. And as a result, can't stand the unpleasant affect, and that can really lead to relapse. So I've found that using some of, you know, these methods, sensory motor psychotherapy and yoga, which I'll talk about a little bit later, have really helped expand the ability of a client's ability to withstand distress, unpleasant emotions, and actually, you know, gain a lot of competence and stability.
So, you know, you said some big words, and possibly
okay.
some of our listeners may not know what co-occurring means. And even though you described
okay.
it, I just want to let the listening audience know that when you have co-occurring disorders, that may look like you have sexual addiction plus anxiety, or anxiety and depression and sexual addiction. So they all are occurring at the same time. And then you said that dysregulation may be a problem for people. So break that down for us and tell us what you mean.
Well, in the language of sensory motor psychotherapy, they often use this term called a window of tolerance. And I think of that as two horizontal lines. And the top line might be the amount of anxiety that you could tolerate before you would really say, you know, I can't stand this anymore. And on the bottom is a different level that they call hypoarousal, and it would be that I can't stand this, so I'm going to totally shut down. And if I could use an animal to explain this, because this is true in animal behavior, I think the audience might understand it better. Sometimes you might walk along a meadow and see a little rabbit, and if you startle it, it will often go into sort of a freeze response. It'll look like a deer caught in the headlights. And that term is called hypoarousal. And people can who have a trauma history can also exhibit that kind of symptom, and it might be because of an old trauma, you know, a car accident or sexual abuse or physical violence. And sometimes those symptoms can get an addict into some trouble in terms of relapse. So when you work on that window of tolerance, what you actually do is try to expand a client's ability to withstand unpleasant emotions. So either expand their ability to withstand anxiety or being with sad or depressed thoughts. And it's a matter of using the body and creating safety and stabilization through this talk therapy method that actually, you know, helps increase a client's ability to withstand some of the cravings and the triggers they might experience along the road to recovery.
You know, that is so wise of you, because clearly many of the clients that I work with, they feel those urges and cravings, and they find them unbearable, and yet their sponsors, their group members, the community will say, just hang in there, feel the feeling, notice what it does, and it too shall pass. It is not going to last. So get used to feeling the feeling and knowing it's going to go away. Maybe you can distract yourself. Maybe you can interrupt it. But it will leave. Don't fight it. Kind of surrender to it.
Well, it is sort of like leaning in, you know, leaning into the emotion. But before you lean in, I think as a therapist, it's important that you give clients a skill set, because they have to lean into something. So what's really the beginning is sort of what we teach in what we call a stage-oriented model of trauma, which is to provide the client with a lot of, you know, grounding and safety tools first. That would be, you know, sort of the first order of business before you'd work on how are they going to lean into, you know, this unpleasant affect.
Okay, so give us an example of some of the tools you use so that they can lean into it and not feel like they're going to fall into it.
Okay, well, there are sort of three categories of tools, and this model is called the Caress model, what I'm going to talk about right now. And this actually, there's a therapist in Baltimore, her name is Lisa Ferenz, and she developed this model to use with substance abuse, but I sort of borrowed it to use with sex addiction because I think it works, you know, really well. And the first, the CARESS is sort of an acronym, and the first two letters, CA, that stands for communication, an alternative form of communication. So what you would teach the client would be, all right, that's when you might get a journal and you'd write about, you know, some unpleasant affect that you're having, or you'd call a sponsor or one of your recovery friends. You might do an art project around something or do, you know, some other form of communication. The second category would be releasing endorphins, the RE in the CARESS. And so that would mean some type of physical activity that you might do. And you don't have to go to the gym. You could jump rope. You could, you know, walk up and down your stairs, some way to release a little bit of energy. Another thing that we know that releases endorphins is laughter. So if you put on a 30-minute, you know, little video clip of an old rerun of one of, you know, a show that you found amusing, that could do it. And we also know that hugging a pet can also release endorphins, playing with a child. So that would be the second part. And then the third part would be the self-soothing technique. So this would be like, you know, rubbing lotion on your hands or taking a warm bath or a shower or aromatherapy, anything that would, you know, reading a good book, candles, anything that would create self-soothing. And I think with a lot of our addicts, sometimes therapists tend to go to that self-soothing part too quickly. And if you're a hyper-aroused, anxiety-prevalent person, going and taking a bath is not going to be your first choice. So oftentimes you have to look at the client and try and figure out what's the best order to get someone in this stable place. So sometimes it takes something more active. You might have some clients go jump rope instead of taking a shower. So it really depends. So those are just some ideas and different categories of what you might do.
Well, and that's something for anybody who's listening. They know that they can do that. And at the same time, you're basically saying not only do you have to deal with the cravings and the urges, but you have to be able to interrupt on some level the actual sensation. And so you came up with some different ways to do that. Now, for a client who has a serious sexual addiction, they really do have to be with a therapist who knows what they're doing. So,
exactly. You
know, obviously you said that this integrated sensory motor psychotherapy is something that you found to be very helpful. Can you give us your website so that we might be able to take a look at you and see what resources are available on that?
Yes, my website is www.ipi, that's I like Idaho, P like Paul, I like Idaho, Virginia, spelled out the whole word, .com.
Okay. And you found that this is more than cognitive behavioral therapy. This actually helps the body sensations that people experience along with the addiction.
Yes, it's really almost the opposite of cognitive behavioral, because you would be starting with the body and, you know, five, what they call sensory perception, which would be, you know, sense of hearing and smell and touch and taste and all the senses, and you would eventually get to the thought or the cognition, but that would be later. And what we have to remember is that when someone is a trauma client, their frontal lobe is often offline, so they can't access cognitive first anyway. They're in too much distress.
Great point.
Which is why cognitive behavioral therapy doesn't work for a lot of addicts. Their brain is not totally online.
Yeah, so they couldn't really do it even if they wanted to, because
it's not their fault.
So damaged. Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. And so, obviously, you've got the techniques available to help clients work through the urges and some of the cravings and that addictive state that's physiologically soothing. And it's not just self-talk, because, like you said, self-talk is not necessarily available if somebody's been using for a long, long time.
Exactly. And we know it takes a while for the brain to heal. So I think it's important that we stage treatment, you know, keeping a sensitivity to what the client might really be able to do.
Mm-hmm. That makes all the sense in the world. Now, I know that you have found this to be so helpful with all types of situations. And you said trauma is what basically got you started in the work of addiction. So tell me a little bit about what is the stage-oriented approach to trauma treatment and, you know, how do you accomplish that effectively?
Okay. This work comes from Judith Herman, and it actually, it isn't recent. It's probably 1992. She wrote a seminal book called Trauma and Recovery. And this book is fairly easy to read. It's not, it's a book certainly that some of our audience could read, but it's also one of the Bible books, I think, that most people who are going to major in trauma and addictive disorders are going to read. And basically, a three-stage model talks about stage one being focusing on all the safety skills, all the stabilization skills, all the skills that are done in early recovery to help people, you know, fight urges and triggers and cravings. So that would be the first stage of trauma treatment. And you wouldn't really talk about the story or, you know, any kind of traumatic event until you'd laid a foundation. I think of it like building a house. You want to have a really strong, firm foundation of safety and stabilization before you start, you know, putting in plumbing and erecting the rest of the house. So that would be stage one. Stage two would be when you felt like there was enough stability, maybe connections, you know, with people in the program, a sponsor, a therapeutic alliance. And that's when you would talk about some of the more traumatic material or, you know, relational difficulties, that might be contributing to relapse and try to do what we call trauma processing. And you could do that in a variety of ways. Sensory motor psychotherapy is one of the ways, a bottom-up approach that I use quite extensively. Another type of therapy that I do a lot for this stage-oriented work, the second stage, is EMDR therapy. And mm-hmm. then another model I use is called ego state or parts work, or another name for it is called internal family systems. So those are the models that I might use for stage two. And then stage three trauma work is what we call reintegration. This is where someone has felt like, you know, they've maintained some sobriety, they've worked through some of their traumatic past, and now rather than kind of facing life as if they are an addict or they are damaged, they see this piece of themselves as more integrated. They're no longer wearing the capital A for addict on their forehead, but it's somehow integrated in the greater, you know, self that they are, and they start to see themselves as you know, being resourced and stable and ready to move forward.
Okay, that's very interesting. And I have been doing this show for over a year and a half, and I've not really had much information about this. So for our listeners, I am sure this is more than likely new information.
Uh-huh.
Now, what prompted you to go this direction? Because there are a variety of techniques you can use. What makes you feel like this is really a very accurate and successful way of looking at trauma as well as treating it?
Well, you know, I think most of us in school, we learn, short and quick methods to bring clients a little bit of relief. But when you look at the research on chronic relapse and you see how many people that suffer from addictions, you know, really don't make it, you know, 2 or 3 years down the road, then you have to start questioning, you know, why is that so? Why do we have such recidivism or relapse with people? And I really think it's because, you know, the extent of trauma, and just using, you know, females, because I don't have all the, you know, the data, but off the top of my head, I know that for women with an addictive disorder, that 74% have reported sexual abuse in the literature, 52% physical abuse and 72% emotional abuse. So when you have that degree of underlying trauma, not to treat that is a real setup for someone to have a relapse. So the next question becomes, well, how do I treat that in a way that is not too disruptive? Because there are other ways, you know, to treat trauma. But what we found is that even though they might be effective, a lot of people can drop out of trauma treatment if it's too overwhelming. And, you know, one of those methods would be what they call exposure therapy, where you have a client, you know, tell you over and over and over again all the, you know, traumatic things that happened to them, hoping that, you know, after they've told the story 100 times, they're not going to feel it. Well, you know, for a lot of people, that could trigger a suicidal ideation.
Sure.
Or dropping out of therapy, and so we never know what happens. So my feeling has been to find, you know, gentler approaches, really kind of paying attention to the client. So it's sort of like, you know, a dance you do with the client, and when they're ready, you move to a higher level of trauma processing. And so some of these methods, you know, using sensory motor and EMDR and then some of the yoga therapy that I also do, I've found have been much more successful approaches. And, of course, I weave that in with Pat Carnes, you know, the TASS model, and that's also a, you know, big component of it. But it's not the only thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you say I weave it in, describe mm-hmm. how you might weave that in just a bit.
Okay. Well, most of the clients that I see are also going to be in a group. So they might be doing their task-oriented, you know, Patrick Carnes work in a process group. And then they might also be doing some individual therapy where they're really focusing on the stage-oriented model, because I know they have a trauma background, and I'm knowing that in order for them not to relapse, we're going to have to focus on trauma treatment. Now, not everyone can afford to do all that. So if I'm taking the entire case, then we're going to work a little bit on tasks, but I may only spend, 10, 15 minutes of the session working on the tasks in the Pat Carnes, books. But then we're going to also be looking at building resources and grounding and stabilization, because I'm knowing trauma work is something else we need to do at the same time. So they really, to me, can't be separate from one another.
Well, absolutely. But I love that you integrate them both, because obviously for our listeners, part of the task, and Pat has about 30 tasks he started with, was it 7 or 8? And, might be the first task might be just breaking through the denial. The second task might be working through understanding what sexual addiction is all about. The third task might be creating resources for you within the community. So there are a variety of tasks that Dr. Carnes feels is necessary to create some solid recovery, and you actually integrate those tasks with your sensory motor trauma work. And that's amazing, because then you're kind of hitting it from all areas and working everything simultaneously.
Yeah. It used to be, years ago when we had a client that had an addiction, it was this belief that someone had to have a whole year of recovery before you would go anywhere near the trauma work. Well, oftentimes if you don't work with the trauma, the client's going to keep relapsing and relapsing and relapsing. It's already in the room. So I think it's, to ignore that piece of it when it's so prominent is a real mistake. But I think, you also have to know how to do trauma work. It's just very, very important, so that you don't re-victimize and re-traumatize a client by going too fast, too soon, and too much.
That's right. Hey, I'm talking with Jan Beauregard, PhD, and she can be found. Her website is www.ipivirginia.org. And that phone number, if you want to get in touch with her and find out more about her resources, is 703-385-9667, extension 1. And you are actually located in Fairfax, Virginia. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay, and you are part of Integrative Psychotherapy Institute, and obviously it is very integrative, and you do look at many approaches for the client. Now, tell us a little bit about your internal family systems work and how that applies to trauma and sexual addiction.
Okay. Well, years ago, when I was actually training to become a therapist, I was working with a psychiatrist who really used what we call this parts model or ego state model to working with trauma. And if we took any client that has an addiction, obviously they're coming in to talk about their addict self. And so you could right away start talking about that part of them that is their addict, with all the personality characteristics and the thought process and the desire and how they act out, and you could kind of flesh that out. And oftentimes when I'm doing this internal family system, or what I call parts work, I use a flip chart with large poster paper, and we start talking about, their internal system, which I call their internal family. And it's a family they can never get rid of. No matter how long they live, they're always going to have their addict. It's just that they're not going to be hijacked by it anymore. It's going to be, you think of like a solar system, and instead of, their addict being like the sun, it's going to be like Pluto if they do a good job in recovery. So we start out with that prominent part, but we also very quickly move to the parts of them that are also resources. They're obviously strengths, or they wouldn't be sitting in front of me. There was a part that brought them into my office that I would consider a strength or a resource, or a part that wanted to live and not die, a part that wanted to get better. So you would then talk about the characteristics of that part, and there might be also parts of them that were their worker selves that did a good job in a career, an occupation. They might be a good mom. They might be a good parent. So it would be, trying to look at all the different aspects of their personality to kind of create an internal map for themselves, so that they could start to see that they had parts of themselves that might be compassionate, as well as parts that are critical. They might have parts that are spiritual. They might have parts that are acting out. And it's a way to really, develop a deep understanding. And there are actually, you know, some books now that are fairly client-friendly that, you know, people can kind of go through. This one I use as sort of a workbook for clients. And if you'd like, I can share that resource.
Yes, give us the book.
Okay. This book is called Parts Work, and it's an illustrated guide to your inner life. And the author is Tom Holmes, H-O-L-M-E-S, and his wife Lori, L-A-U-R-I, Holmes. And it's sort of like a workbook, and it starts out, you know, talking about, you know, the parts that, how they develop, and it's often related to family of origin and, you know, some of the interactions you might have had with family and siblings and so forth, and your experiences. So you develop these parts of yourself that, you know, try to survive, and parts that adapt or help, and parts that are strong. And then, you know, the recovery work is about trying to get all those parts to work in balance.
Well, you know, in some ways that makes so much sense, because typically when clients have sexual addiction, they do what we call compartmentalize, and they go, well, I love my family over here, and I do a great job at work, and I have this sexual addiction, and it doesn't really hurt anybody because nobody knows, and this is the dark side of me, and they compartmentalize everything. And what you're talking about is, in some ways, using some of that same strategy to help clients understand the different parts of themselves, develop the internal maps, and also identify themselves by some of their strengths and not just the blame, shame, and guilt.
Exactly. And there are so many therapeutic activities with guided imagery to use with this model that can be really helpful, especially if you have a client that is expressive. They're, you know, more right brain, intuitive, and artistic. It can be a really good model. And, you know, what I try to do is early on identify some of the, you know, personality strengths of my clients, because not every model is going to work for everyone. So, you know, it's important, I think, to have a toolkit as a therapist so that you can bring the right therapeutic technique, you know, to the client that's struggling.
Well, I'll definitely take a look at that Parts Work by Tom and Lori Holmes, because I'm always looking for, especially workbooks, things that are very helpful that a client can work through and do, because, of course, that redirects the brain in so many ways and offsets some of the neurochemistry that occurs with sexual addiction when people are really working right brain and left brain to actually recover. So I love that. Is there anything else you might recommend when it comes to books?
Well, that would be the one I think, you know, would be for clients, this Parts workbook. There are books, of course, that would be more for clinicians. Richard Schwartz is the internal family systems guru, and he wrote a book called Internal Family Systems. But that's more of a clinical book. I like this one because this one is very client-friendly, and oftentimes if I'm going to move into this model, I kind of have them, you know, do a little bit of this book each time, because I'm going to be developing sort of their map and have them understand, you know, the different parts of themselves. And they're like, the parts of themselves are like what I call their psychological software programs. And once they understand them, I want them to see them like little icons on their computer screen. And we can move those around, you know, if we know where they are and what they are. And some of them are going to be helpful, and other ones are going to cause viruses in the system. So, you know, it can be a playful way to really help clients. And most clients really like this model a lot.
Absolutely. Metaphorically, that makes so much sense.
Now, and you can weave in spirituality with this. You know, it's really a good model.
Well, I know that you have been using trauma-sensitive yoga, and you recommend this for many of your clients. So I wanted you to talk a little bit about what trauma-sensitive yoga is and how it's different from a regular yoga class.
Okay, well, this one is probably something that was part of my own personal journey that I ended up benefiting from so much that I brought it into my practice. And sometimes, you know, as clinicians, we discover things when we're not meaning to. And because I sit so much, you know, at work, I wanted to develop, you know, some kind of practice or avenue that, you know, helped me with my work. as well as got me moving. So I tried a variety of yoga classes, but it was really interesting because I found that in some of them, I was really bothered by the approach. You know, instructors might come up and, you know, move my body around and touch me when I didn't ask to be touched, or step on my feet, or yell commands like a drill sergeant. And I started thinking about how that could impact a client of mine that might have had a sexual abuse history or a trauma history. And I thought to myself, you know, there has to be something else. And after trying a variety of yoga classes and then doing a little bit of research, I stumbled on to three different models of what is called now trauma-sensitive yoga. And it's starting to make its way into you know, books and training programs all across the United States. And now some of the addiction professionals like myself are actually teaching it. So when I do trainings, trauma trainings, I'm usually incorporating a segment of this trauma-sensitive yoga work so that clinicians can start doing a little bit of it with their practice, you know, in their practice. So basically, a trauma-sensitive approach would be when you're trying to explain like a posture to a client. You would do it in non-threatening language. It wouldn't be like a command, but you might say to a client, you know, if you wish, you know, place your hands on your hips, and if it's comfortable, you have your mouth open when you breathe. If not, it's okay to keep your mouth closed. Everything is about using permissive language, and that can be so empowering for a client that has, you know, had you know, an abuse history, because it allows some flexibility. So the only time a trauma-sensitive yoga practitioner would correct a client would be if they were doing something that they might get injured or it would be unsafe. But other than that, it is much more flexible in terms of you know, what a client can do, which has them feel more confident as well.
Well, and it gives them choice, and that's
obviously
what a lot of abuse victims never had.
Exactly. And a second component to trauma-sensitive yoga is it's woven in with a lot of affirmations. So this is similar to when we think of, you know, the 12 steps and how we have so many slogans that are helpful. The affirmations, if you're doing a pose, for instance, if you did a pose like a warrior stance, you might say, you know, I am smart and wise, or I am powerful, or I have the right to stand up for myself. So when you add these affirmations to a pose, it can really, again, integrate, you know, the thought, the emotion, and the strength in the body. So you've once again, you know, kind of done, mind, body, and spirit all at the same time. So I have started, I have a fairly big office, and I can bring in, you know, weights and balls and things. And so I have started with some of my clients that are open to it, teaching them a variety of yoga postures, and some of them can be used for grounding, for reducing anxiety, for coping with depression. And so this has been a new venture for me, and I can share some of the people, if you want to know, you know, where some of this information is, and some of our audience does, I can give you a few, you know, names of people.
Yeah, if you would, we've got about a minute left, so give
okay.
us some referrals.
I'll give you the most, you know, easy, like, user-friendly website. Mm-hmm. The practitioner is in Tucson, Arizona, and her name is Amy Weintaub, Weintaub, and she wrote a really good book called Yoga for Anxiety and Depression, and she has a lot of CDs and DVDs available. And they're online, and you can Google her name on YouTube and actually listen to a couple interviews that she does talking about how yoga can be used for anxiety, depression, and PTSD. And then for anyone that's a veteran out there, there's another program called Yoga Warriors. And the person that developed this model, her name is Lucy Cimini, C-I-M-I-N-I, and she's located in central Massachusetts, and she focuses on vets, some, you know, that are handicapped, they may have lost a limb, and teaches them how to reconnect to their body and feel empowered using this yoga warrior model.
thank you so much for sharing this new information with my audience, with me. Again, Jan works with and for Integrative Psychotherapy Institute. That's www.ipivirginia.org. And thank you again. I look forward to talking more about this in the future.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity tonight.
All right, Jan. Have a great night. And for all my listeners, there'll only be one of you at all times, so fearlessly have the courage to be yourself. Have a great day.
Bye now.